Hi, I'm Dina Burke, the host of Super Money, a podcast about Bitcoin for total beginners. Welcome to episode 3 of our show entitled Bitcoin in Crisis. So today we're going to spend some time looking at a couple high-profile crimes and scams that have involved Bitcoin. And now I get that it may seem like a bad idea to dedicate a whole episode to this topic, especially so early on in the lifetime of this podcast. But I sort of feel like if I don't tell you about these things, then someone else will. And that person may have ulterior motives to try and convince you that like Bitcoin is bad and only used by criminals. And I hear this a lot. And in response to that line of thinking and that argument, I always say, of course, criminals use Bitcoin. Criminals use dollars too. And in fact, the US Treasury has said recently that dollars have financed exponentially more illegal activity and terrorist activity than Bitcoin. I know I'm sounding really defensive right now, and that's just because I have to deal with skeptics all the time and I have a lot of well-worn arguments. But yes, at the end of the day, major crimes have happened, and I want to get out in front of the big ones with you all so that you're prepared should any Bitcoin naysayers corner you the next time you're at happy hour. If this is the first time you're listening, hello and welcome. And if you need the foundations of how everything works, of like what Bitcoin is more generally, episode 1 will be 10 minutes very well spent. Okay, so jumping in. I thought a lot about which cases to highlight in this episode, and I've chosen 2, which I think are emblematic of the big problems in the industry. And the first one we're going to look at is Silk Road. You may have heard of Silk Road, as it's a story that's definitely bigger than Bitcoin. It's a tale of crime that's just so, so unique to our times. And as a result, it got a ton of headlines, and it continues to this day. So Silk Road was an online black market. So it was a marketplace and it sold illegal things, mostly drugs, but also stuff like stolen driver's licenses. It was a darknet site, meaning you could only access it with this special browser. And these special browsers, the main one is called Tor. And this allowed people to access a site in a way that was really private and anonymous. So Silk Road was started in 2011 by a programmer named Ross Ulbricht. And Ross was a Penn State graduate student. He was very much a libertarian. And it's reported that he imagined Silk Road to be this like free market experiment, totally out of the reach of government interference. So Ross creates Silk Road in 2011, and he needed to figure out a way to deal with payments. Credit cards and bank wires obviously wouldn't work since this needed to be an anonymous platform with anonymous transactions, and sending cash in the mail is clearly impractical. So Ross solved this problem with payments with Bitcoin. The blockchain, since it's transparent, it could act as a way to verify that the payments have been made and completed, and the sender and receiver could both remain quote unquote anonymous. Now, I'm going to pause here in the story for a very, very, very important side note. Bitcoin transactions are not at all anonymous. They are just pseudonymous, meaning they don't reveal name or personally identifiable information. But every single transaction is published with both the sender and receiver's wallet addresses. Everyone can see this information, including law enforcement. And if someone was sloppy about how they use their wallet, like if they did a transaction on Silk Road and then went on to use that same wallet address to make like a donation or move some money onto Coinbase, somewhere where personally identifiable information is required, then that is basically an ironclad paper trail back to the original transaction on Silk Road and therefore the crime. In fact, researchers recently found over 100 cases where someone made a payment on a dark website, which was then traceable to a public account with attached to someone's name. So again, this is another reason why using Bitcoin as a tool for financial fraud, it really is not all it's cracked up to be, and is problematic in many ways. Okay, so back to the story. So Ross starts this marketplace, and the first items listed for sale are psychedelic mushrooms that he grew himself. And to get the word out, he promotes the site on the same Bitcoin forum that I mentioned in last week's episode. So Bitcoin Talk, it's the same forum where Satoshi was hanging out in the early days. So Ross posts on Bitcoin Talk, and this is eventually the thing that will bring him down. But at first, it seemed like a great idea because he starts to get customers. And things pick up. Over the next couple months, Gawker publishes a piece on the site, and soon it's just buzzing with buyers and sellers and reviews and everything. It's like an eBay for drugs. Now the site is growing, and the DEA and the FBI are like, no way we're letting this happen on our watch. So a task force is set up, and agents start going in undercover to try and infiltrate the community. And it works. One of the agents set up an account called Nob, and Nob posts a listing for a large amount of cocaine. And at first, this listing makes people suspicious because Nob doesn't have any other reviews as a seller, but Nob had done enough legwork to build a rapport in the community so that soon there's a buyer. And the buyer is one of the administrators of the site. Like, it just happened to be that one of the admin of the site that Ross had brought on to help. So this admin, they're called Chronic Pain. And Chronic Pain thinks they are buying cocaine from Nob. And of course, it's just a sting operation. And Chronic Pain is arrested. And once Chronic Pain is arrested, he flips and he agrees to cooperate with law enforcement to build the case against Silk Road and to get Ross. And now this is where it gets very weird. So Ross gets wind of the arrest, and he thinks that it was Chronic Pain, a guy named Curtis Green. He thinks that Chronic Pain betrayed him, when of course it was Nob that was a cop, but Ross doesn't know this yet. So he asks Nob if he could have Curtis Green executed. Nob says yes, and then they staged the death of Curtis Green, like complete with pictures and everything. This happened 4 more times in the lifetime of Silk Road, where Ross ordered the execution of various members of the community that he thought had flipped on him. And it's really important to note that no one actually died, but the fact that Ross ordered these executions definitely came back to haunt him in his eventual trial. Okay, so then it's 2013, and the site is exploding in popularity, and Silk Road is making tons of money in commission fees. Meanwhile, the FBI and the DEA are closing in. They're making arrests of buyers and sellers, like left and right. Ross is getting super paranoid and suspicious about everyone, but the task force hasn't yet figured out who is at the helm because Ross is extremely careful about masking his IP address always and shielding his true identity from everyone and his location. Like, he is an expert at this. But the real break in the case happened from a pretty stupid mistake that Ross had made years earlier. So in one of those original Bitcoin Talk forum posts promoting Silk Road, Ross had put in his email address, which like had his name in it. So when the task force found this, at first they were like, no way is this him. It's too obvious and like too stupid of a mistake. But then they find a few more things connecting Ross to Silk Road, including an IP address that was linked to a location in San Francisco that they thought was maybe connected to one of Silk Road's servers. So the FBI and the DEA have the guy, and they start tracking his every move, preparing for a big sting. And this sting happens on October 1st, 2013, when Ross goes to a public library in San Francisco with his laptop to do some work. The task force at the same time was posing as a moderator of his site, which had some questions about a couple things. And the moderator's online, and they're asking Ross to check a couple of posts that they flagged. This meant that Ross had to log into this heavily encrypted back end of the site to check on what the moderator was asking him. And once they saw that Ross was logged in, 2 agents that were in the library distracted him by pretending to argue and fight in the stacks behind him. And so then Ross turns around and another agent comes in and swipes his laptop, and then he's quickly arrested after that. Now, after the sting, Ross was charged with narcotics conspiracy, money laundering, and solicitation of murder for hire. And he is currently serving a double life sentence plus 40 years. As you can imagine, after the arrest, many people had a lot of things to say about Bitcoin and its role in Silk Road and criminal activity more generally. But in many ways, the event strengthened the legitimacy of Bitcoin because law enforcement had to come out saying that, like, the using of Bitcoin wasn't the crime here, the selling of drugs was. Plus, it was also a really good showcase of how the transparency and permanence of the Bitcoin blockchain can be a great tool for law enforcement to trace criminal activity back to a person. So there was actually so much more to the Silk Road case that I could talk about here, including whether or not Ross deserves the double life sentence that he was given. So if this interests you, check out the show notes where I'll leave some links on more reading that you can do on this case. All right, so we're on to part two of this podcast, and we're going to look at an altogether different case of crypto-related fraud. This one involves a Canadian crypto exchange called Quadriga. I'm not going to tell this one chronologically, and instead I'm going to start with a little lesson before we jump into the drama. So one of the fundamentals about Bitcoin is that once you get your hands on some, you're going to want to move that stash to a wallet that you own, like a Bitcoin wallet. So one of the first things that you do when you buy some Bitcoin off an exchange or from a Bitcoin ATM or whatever is you transfer that Bitcoin into your own wallet. And a wallet is made up of two things, a public key and a private key. A public key is your wallet address. So it's a unique string of letters and numbers that points to this place that you own. So people can use this public key as, like, it's basically like a destination address when you are going to be receiving Bitcoin. So you send that out to someone that's sending you some, and you can share it freely. And like I mentioned in the Silk Road story, this public key or your wallet address, this is the thing that's published on the blockchain and is therefore totally traceable. The second thing that makes up a wallet is something called a private key. Now, your private key must always be kept private. No one needs to know your private key when they're sending you Bitcoin. All they need is your public key or your wallet address. Your private key is like your very secret special password that unlocks your wallet and gives you access to whatever Bitcoin is in there. And if you lose the private key, there is no other way to access the Bitcoin at that address. Now, this is one of the things that makes Bitcoin awesome, because you have total control of your wallet. And unless you give someone your private key, no one else in the world can access the Bitcoin in your wallet. But this is also one of the things that makes newcomers so nervous about Bitcoin, because if you lose your private key, there's no Bitcoin helpline that you can call to fix it or reinstate access to your account or whatever, like you can do if you lost your banking app password. Like, if this happens and you lose your private key, once it's gone, it's gone. There's no getting into that wallet, and the Bitcoin is essentially trapped there forever. This is relevant to the Quadriga story because these fundamentals are at the center of why it's such a huge mystery. Okay, so the story. Let's start it on the 14th of January, 2019, when the Canadian cryptocurrency exchange called Quadriga, they post on their Facebook page that their CEO and co-founder, Gerald Cotton, had died a month earlier in India due to complications from Crohn's disease. Gerald was only 30 years old at the time of his death, and he was traveling with his girlfriend at the time. Quadriga had, at the time of Gerald's death, about 115,000 users, and it was holding about $140 million worth of funds on behalf of these users. So in other words, people had come to the Quadriga exchange to buy some Bitcoin or some other cryptocurrency. They had bought it, but the Bitcoin or the other cryptocurrency was still with the exchange. Like, the customers hadn't yet moved their crypto to their own wallets yet. So you can sort of think of it like a bank. The bank had 115,000 customers and had about $140 million in the vault. That was the customer's money. So Gerald died, and his company is holding all this crypto on behalf of its customers. And then it comes out that he was the only person that had access to the private keys of the wallets where these reserves were held. And he didn't write it down or put these private keys anywhere. So the funds were effectively lost. Without these private keys, nobody, not Justin Trudeau himself, could get to this money. And if the dude was dead and he really didn't share the private keys, then the money was trapped there forever. So with this bank metaphor, the vault is locked and no one could get in to access their own money. And as you can imagine, the outrage begins immediately. Quadriga was one of Canada's most popular places to buy cryptocurrencies. And many of its customers were just like regular people who bought Bitcoin. They weren't big financial institutions that lost like $140 million that could recoup it with insurance. Like, these are individual investors and they are pissed. And speculation quickly follows the outrage. Reddit users in particular like spring into action, and they start looking at all of the technical details of the exchange, like its wallet addresses, and they started piecing together how the operations of this business worked. So specifically, they were looking at how the funds moved between wallets belonging to Quadriga and wallets that didn't belong to Quadriga. So like I've said before, Bitcoin is transparent, right? And you can see every single transaction that's ever happened. So once you're able to identify a wallet address as belonging to someone, like an individual or a company, you can follow the money around and start to draw a picture of how everything moved around. And that picture did not look good. So money was being transferred between wallets in suspicious ways, and funds were also moving to other exchanges, and the accounts on those other exchanges were making huge, crazy investment bets on these smaller, like emerging cryptocurrencies. And those bets were not coming out on the right side. So it was increasingly looking like he had either been like basically gambling with the customer money by making these really risky trades, or siphoning off the money to his own wallets. And maybe both was happening. So on a parallel path, questions about Gerald's character start coming up. There were these leaked emails of a time right before his death where he joked about retiring soon and having a, quote, safe bolted to the rafters. People also dug up these old interviews where Gerald seemed to address the issue at hand very directly. So there was this interview from 2014 where he claimed that he wrote his passwords and his private keys on paper and then locked them in a safe deposit box at a bank. And he also confided in close friends that he had a, quote, dead man switch that would send a few people, like few key people, access to these private keys and the exchange's funds in the case of his disappearance or death. Now, neither of those things were true. And it just seems odd, having said those things publicly and privately, that he actually didn't have any sort of process in place. Also, being the CEO of a major exchange, you would definitely have this type of process in place. Also, details about his past and the past of his co-founder slash advisor, this man named Michael Patron, came to light, and it just wasn't good. So the two men met on an internet forum when Gerald was 15 and Michael was 21, and the forum was centered around something called high-yield investment opportunities, and these are also known as Ponzi schemes. So the story goes that Gerald and Michael both tried to scam one another and they couldn't, and then they became friends. So Gerald sets up his first high yield investment company, aka a Ponzi scheme, when he was 15. And it's come to light that between the time of their meeting and when they set up Quadriga in 2013, there were other Ponzi schemes that they ran and money laundering operations, one of which involved jail time for Michael. So all that said, they had very successfully scrubbed this past when they started Quadriga together in 2013. No one knew. So there's this amazing Vanity Fair article that I'll link to in the show notes that goes through three possible theories for what happened to Gerald and the Quadriga money. The first, and the most generous by far, is a scenario in which Gerald starts this company with this bad guy collaborator, Michael, and him and Michael just start growing this operation in like a really rickety way. And the company is intended to be like in no way a healthy and sustainable business, and it isn't. And then Michael quits in 2016, right before the crazy price increase in Bitcoin. And Gerald gets left with this business that's just like plagued with problems. And he gets in over his head just as a ton of new customers and money are coming in. So the second scenario is that the money was basically just gambled away on high-risk trades. it's not locked up in some wallet somewhere without the keys. Like, Gerald just got in over his head because he made a lot of bad bets using the money that his customers had deposited into his exchange and had therefore entrusted him with. That's basically like your bank teller taking the paycheck that you just deposited and heading down to the racetracks. Like, it sucks. The third theory, which is the most salacious, is that Gerald is not dead. He's alive, and he's orchestrated his death and is out living on some island somewhere with all this money. And this seems insane, I know, but as the author of that Vanity Fair piece put it so wisely, like, it needs to seem far-fetched for it to work. So suddenly all the foreign travel this guy bragged about, like where he was sometimes seen with briefcases of cash, maybe that was him moving money into offshore accounts that he could then access after his quote unquote death. And that safe that he said was bolted to the rafters, it's gone. And what's left behind are four bolt holes in the ceiling. It's super sketchy. His girlfriend is still in Canada. And she recently had to turn over about $10 million in assets as a result of the investigations and the fraud that was discovered since his death. She maintains that Gerald is in fact dead and that no, you cannot dig up his body to double check. So what will happen next? I have no idea, but I do feel a ton of compassion for people who lost money with Quadriga. Like, that's awful. And the whole industry hurts when we see fraud like this. Every high-profile hack or fraud is bad for everyone trying to build something in crypto, and no one wants to see this happen again. I suspect we'll see a ramping up of regulation as a result, which is good and also bad in ways. But one clear lesson coming out of this is that you shouldn't keep large sums of money on any exchange. Cryptocurrencies can move around very easily. That's one of the very cool things about it, but it also makes crypto very susceptible to scams like we saw at Quadriga. So stick to the reputable exchanges and move your money into your own wallet that you control as soon as you have any sum of money that matters. Okay, that's it for today's show. Next week, I'm going to do a frequently asked questions episode. So please hit me up with any of your Bitcoin or crypto related queries. There is no such thing as a stupid question, and I am here to answer them all, and I love it. So I'll leave my contact info in the show notes, and I hope to hear from you. Okay, I think that's it for now. Thank you so much for listening. Bye.